Okay, welcome to our third lecture in our series. My name is Beppe Pezzini, and I am a classicist and a professor in Latin language and literature at Corpus Christi College. And today I will start, if you want, for my expertise on Latin language and literature, its reception, but talk more about Tolkien. I am myself also a Tolkien scholar and the editor of the Journal of Inkling Studies, which is one of the few journals dedicated to Tolkien. So today I'm going to give a contribution to a field of research which has been, if you want, growing in the past couple of years, which is called, which we may call the classical reception in Tolkien, as you can see on the handout number one. We have seen in the past 2 years the publication of two books dedicated to Tolkien and the classics. I know there is a third one which should come out next year with a French publisher. I am personally very happy that there has been this broadening of scope in Tolkien studies. For many decades, Tolkien has only been considered a medievalist, an English philologist, whereas in the past 10, 15, 20 years, people have started to understand that the influence on Tolkien is much broader than that. A Spanish scholar known as Martin Simonson, as for instance, written a very good book showing how well-versed Tolkien was in modern and modernist literature. Another scholar was called Holly Ordway, who was here in Oslo at the beginning of September, has also written a book on that. Tolkien was certainly a medievalist, he was certainly a philologist, but he was also a romantic, a modernist, a symbolist, I would argue, a novelist, and certainly was a classicist. And I think that the title classicist is especially appropriate, as you can see. Tolkien has an extensive training in classics at King Edward School in Birmingham, which was one of the most prestigious grammar schools at the end and beginning of the 20th century. He had learned from his mother how to write and speak Latin from the age of six, and he always mastered the language very well until the end of his life. At school, for instance, we know that he was quite good at conversing and composing original Greek and Latin text, and that's also a skill that the headmaster of King Edward School, who's called Robert Gilson, was especially good at and maybe even obsessed with. We know that Tolkien engaged in this Latin prose composition, even Latin verse composition exercises, and participated in debates in Latin and Greek. So it is not surprising that Tolkien decided to apply to study classics in this very university. He applied to Corpus Christi College first, my college, then he didn't get in, but he applied again and eventually went to Exeter College. And there he took the Mots examination in 1913, February, March 1913, which is in a sense is very similar to the examination our students take nowadays. As we know, he soon transferred to this school, to the English school, which of course was not here yet, but he never betrayed or rejected his classical training. His work is filled with classical resonances, and he himself often acknowledged his extensive use of classical images and tropes. So for instance, as you can see on the handout, Tolkien himself explicitly referred to classical epic to describe elements of his secondary world, the world of Middle-earth, including, for instance, the heroic horsemen of the Second Age, who, according to Tolkien, lived in a Homeric state. Influence of classical epic have been also identified in the catabasis of Gandalf in Moria and Aragorn on the Paths of the Dead, and also people have recognized the classical imprint in the Fall of Gondolin, for instance, which does recall the fall, the escape of Aeneas from Troy, but also many other narrative topoi and scenes, such as the Catalogue of the Warriors, the Blind of the Troll in The Hobbit, the Battle at the River, the Nostos, the Return of an Exiled King, and the list could be easily expanded. And I don't have the time to go through all of this, but you see, I put on the handout a bit more material, some of them suggested by editors, by other scholars, some by myself. So what I'm going to do in this lecture together is to discuss some key patterns of classical reception in Tolkien, and I will take in particular one case study. And the case study I'm going to discuss is the case study of the narrative of decline, number 2 on the handout. By narrative of decline, I essentially refer to any historical patterns which posit a gradual degradation, and especially moral and ontological, of human beings and of nature from an idealized past, a golden age or a Eden within a Christian tradition. And we are certainly very sure that Tolkien was very much interested in this class narrative of decline. And as I'm going to show, we can see very often the classical ancestry. Number two on the handout. And when we talk about classical ancestry, we should refer first of all to what is, we may say, the archetype of narratives of decline within classical literature, and we may even say within Western literature as such. And that's the myth of the ages of man, as retold by Hesiod in The Works and Days. You see on the handout, I gave you the beginning of it, the beginning of that passage. This myth was super influential in ancient literature, both in Greek and in Latin authors. One, a very famous one who repeated, retold the same myth is Ovid in the Metamorphoses, Book 1. But narratives of decline are not also found in Hesiod and in his reception. For instance, in a sense, we can already trace hints of this narrative in Homer, both in the Iliad and in the Odyssey, where remarks about, as you can see on the handout, the idea that ancient men of old were stronger than the current generation. And we do find the same sort of remarks also in Virgil's Aeneid, you can see on the handout. We know very well, of course, that Tolkien was very familiar with both Homer and Virgil, and a student from the University of Thessaloniki was visiting here back in September, went to study in the board in the Tolkien archive a copy of the Aeneid, and we see how that very passage of quote is underlined, and there is a note, I mean, just a grammatical note, but we can see how well Tolkien knew the Aeneid in particular. This narrative of decline is not just found in epic, but is also widespread in a lot of different Greek and Roman sources. And pretty soon it coalesced, especially in the Roman tradition, with the idea of the mores maiorum, the customs of the past. I put a couple of passages from Plautus, a Roman playwright of the early 2nd century BC, where we already find this idea of the mores maiorum. And when we move forward to the 2nd century, for the 1st century BC, the classical age, we see how Hesiod narrative decline comes as embraced, if you want, these more traditional discourses can transform itself in a sort of coherent narrative. When we go down to late antiquity, 2nd century AD, this narrative of decline becomes so embedded within the Roman cultural discourses that Christian authors such as Augustine will make fun of the pagans because of their obsession with the idealization of the past. You see, especially the first two books of Augustine's De Civitate Dei are filled with this sort of mocking of this narrative. If you turn the page, number three on the handout, in one important, significant and influential version of the narrative, this idealization of the past assumes a very strong primitivist dimension. Again, this is the version we may say that it is already found in Hesiod, in the sense that the golden race of man, that the first race, in the, using of his terminology, the first race of people, I quote, for these people, the grain-giving field brought crops of its own accord, much and unstinting. In this golden age period, there was no technology, there was no agriculture, there was no sailing. The earth, the land will produce, out of its own accord, food. And this is important because also suggests a theoretical framework according to which the relationship between humanity and nature is unspoiled. And we come back on this later on. We find the same idea in Latin authors such as Catullus 64, very important poem of Catullus, but also in Propertius and in Seneca. And this primitivist account is quite often related to the idea, to the stigmatization of sailing. The image of sailing in particular is almost presenting as a sort of rape of the earth, which gives, which marks the beginning of the decline in the history of mankind. Another version, which is the one you find number four on the handout, is less primitivistic, in the sense that in this case, the moral deterioration, the moral decline does not directly stem from technological or cultural advancement. Actually, the trajectory is the opposite. And we find perhaps the most influential version of this narrative in Plato, in the myths of Atlantis, as retold in the Timaeus, but especially in the Critias. The description of the island of Atlantis does follow the pattern, the motive of the natural paradise, and yet, and that's an important point, its inhabitants did not engage in some form of primitive pastoralism, but actually they were very skilled in mine work, in agriculture, in workmanship, and indeed in seafaring. To the point, I quote, that their art and architecture was such as befitted the greatness of the kingdom. And another quote, the wealth of the Atlanteans, therefore, was so immense that the like had never been seen before in any royal house, nor will easily be seen again. And they were well provided with everything of which provision was needed. So you see, in the second version, in a sense, the idealized past is a past with filled with technology. Actually, we know that according to some tradition, the Atlanteans were technological people. They had great technology, much more than the contemporary Athens. We find a similar version of this myth in the Stoic philosophy, both philosophy of history and philosophy of language, according to which this philosophy, the first age of mankind, humankind, was marked by the presence of sages. And the sages are the ones that invented language, and they also are the ones that invented art and technology for the first time. Moving forward, number five on the handout, there is a common trait between these two different and yet similar versions of the narrative of decline. That is to say, the fact that there is a correlation between decline and the relationship with the divine, the relationship between the human and the gods. For instance, I quote, the golden men of the Hesiodic tradition lived like gods and were loved and blessed by the gods. And in contrast, in a negative outlook of the current generation, that as the one given by Catullus in poem 64, the interaction between human beings and divine beings is impossible. And this impossibility of communication is represented as one of the key features of the age of iron, the last age of all. And in fact, even in Plato, and I quote again, there is this idea that its people, the people of Atlantis, gradually lose their original portion of divinity, I quote from the Critias, and this portion of divinity became faint and weak through being oftentimes blended with a large measure of mortality. So there is the idea of a blending of the divine with the mortal. And this is exactly what causes, according to Plato, the moral and also eventually political decline of and collapse of their civilization. Both these primitivist and technological versions can actually be found in the same sources. Now I'm kind of dividing them up, but actually quite often they coexist, or they are integrated into cyclical models. So you can have a version of the decline at the beginning, from highest technology to the lowest technology, but then there is a reverse, and you start from the lowest technology to the highest. So in ancient tradition, these narratives of decline are very persuasive, very pervasive, but they are quite often, in a sense, mixed up. But what we can say is that in any version that we read from antiquity, decline, the notion of declines of any kind remains the unavoidable trajectory of history. This is really, I think, a perception which is really characteristic of ancient culture, and it's found in any possible cultural production, from philosophy down to popular wisdom, from Homer down to the late antique Roman authors. And we know, we are certain, that Tolkien's imagination had been fed by this narrative decline since the early years. With the only exception of a famine of Cato, all the texts that I referred to so far, from Homer to Hesiod, from Virgil to Ovid, were present in the syllabus of the classical syllabus that Tolkien was acquainted with, either at Case or in Oxford University. And I went to check especially what was on the syllabus for Moth 1913, and I can tell you that Hesiod was there together with Ovid and Catullus. So moving now at last, after this introduction, but I needed that, moving forward to number six, we can say, that, of course, that narratives of decline are omnipresent and wide-ranging in Tolkien. The Lord of the Rings, for instance, and I hope you can follow on the handout, the Lord of the Rings abounds in allusion to the superiority of past generation and cultures, very similar indeed to the ones we find in Homer or Virgil. So for instance, but this is just one of many, I quote from the very beginning of the prologue, the hobbits have dwindled, they say, in ancient days they were taller. So even from a physical point of view, there is a decline. These definite allusions resonate with the visual landscape, which is strewn with ruins or ancestral buildings, such as, just to give you one example, the statues of the Argonauts, who are presented as have been the vestiges of a lost civilization, I quote, of a long vanished kingdom. Also, as in the Hesiodic myth, the humans of the Lord of the Rings, human beings of the Lord of the Rings, fail and die much more easily than their ancestors, who instead, just like in Hesiod, live much longer lives, and the kind of lives they live was much more similar to the ones of the Golden Age men of the Hesiodic tradition. In fact, we know that when they died, it was though they were overcome with sleep. The Numenoreans, in many respects, could be described as golden men. Also, in the Lord of the Rings and in the Hobbit, artifacts and artworks which are produced by the current generations cannot equal with the works of ancient masters. In the Council of Erin, for instance, the dwarf Glorin will say that in metalwork we cannot rival our fathers, many of whose secrets are lost. And this idea that lore, both artistic but also intellectual, if you want, that lore is no longer pursued, is also found in many other passages. Again, you find another one on the handout. When Tolkien, the narrator, describes the healing lore in the Houses of Healing, he comments that all lore was in these latter days fallen from its fullness of old. And even the language, which is used by the characters of the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, is described as a corrupted shadow of an ancestral perfection. I gave you on the handout a beautiful passage from The Hobbit when Bilbo gets into the lair of Smaug. The narrator will comment that there are no words, I quote, left to express his temperament, since men changed the language that they learned of elves in the days when all the world was wonderful. The idea of a declining language is very common in ancient discourses on the origin of language, including, of course, Plato's Catullus, but also the Stoics. Don't have the time to spend more time on it, but it's quite clear how the Catullus was a text, Plato's Catullus was a text that was quite present in the discourses at the beginning of the 20th century. So we may say that the Lord of the Rings is set in a sort of fictional or secondary late antiquity, to be considered as a historiographical rather than a historical construct. There is a historiographical notion about this late antiquity. It's not that it's late as a whole, but it is late in the sense that it is filled and dominated by a sense of loss and decline. And I think it's not coincidental that Tolkien himself in his letters observed, I quote, that the heart-racking sense of the vanished past was the emotion which moved him supremely and found small difficulty in evoking. So we may say how there is something very at the very core of Tolkien's literary sensitivity as regards this narrative of the decline. If you turn the page, number 7 on the handout, you can see that Tolkien's declinism is even more evident at the macro historical level, as we see it, for instance, in the Silmarillion, but other in posthumous works. As you know, of course, the history of the secondary world, the history of Vardar, is divided into a series of ages, a bit like in Hesiod, and each age is inferior to the previous one in some respect. And also each one, again, as typical in ancient narratives of decline, degenerates through a moral corruption and involves a gradual diminishing of the divine interaction. To the point, as we know, that in Lord of the Rings, the divine interaction is almost equal to zero. A key notion with this vision of declinism of Tolkien is, of course, the idea of a fall. we talking again and again will say that his work is imbued with the idea of a fall. Of course, Tolkien was a committed Christian, so when talking about fall, he would also talk about a fall in a Christian sense from Eden. But in fact, to understand Tolkien, we also need to realize that it's quite clear how this concept of fall had also been influenced by many other different traditions, including indeed the classical ones. I just gave you an example on the handout. If you see at the bottom of page number 7, that's the example, so over number 7 on the handout, that's the case of the tale of Turin Turambar. As you know, this is a tale, if you want, which is imbued with narrative decline, but it would be really incorrect just to see the Christian imprint in this tale. It's quite clear how we find behind Turin, we have, in a sense, the shadow of Oedipus, of the incest of Oedipus, but also the shadow of Sigurd from the Nordic tradition, and also the shadow of Kullervo from the Finnish one. As typical, Tolkien likes to bring together a lot of different ingredients into his soup. The most important, however, example of narrative decline in Tolkien, number 8 on the handout, is also the one in which the classical ancestry is impossible to deny because it is explicit. Number 8 on the handout, this is, of course, the tale of the fall of Numenor, which is, of course, intimately connected to Plato's story of Atlantis. Tolkien himself, again and again in his letters, will refer to the island as Numenor Atlantis, and in an amended version of the myth, as we can see, as we can read in one of the volumes of the History of Middle-earth, we can see how there is even the idea that Tolkien originally was supposed to go back in time at the time of Numenor and write down the version of the myth of Atlantis. As you can see, I began an abortive book, that's number 9 on the handout, of time travel, of which the end was to be the presence of my hero in the drawing of Atlantis. That's, if you want, the origin of the Numenorean tale. Even in later versions of the story, where, if you want, the classical shadow, the classical ancestry is a bit less evident, still Tolkien would like to keep some form of connection with the Atlantis myth, and this is, if you want, is epitomized by the choice to give a specific etymology, an intriguing etymology, to the name Atlantis. I quote from letter 347, "It is a curious chance that the stem Talat, used in Quenya, the Elvish language, for slipping, sliding, falling down, of which Atlantis is a normal noun formation, should much resemble Atlantis." So this, according to this note, in a typical Tolkien fashion, the similarity between the two myths is a coincidence. Of course, it is not a coincidence, but the very fact that he kind of uses this sort of language, this sort of etymological, I wouldn't call it even a joke, more of a fiction, I think says a lot about Tolkien's perception and understanding of classical reception. In fact, I think we should ask, in what sense can Tolkien say that a word from his own invented languages accidentally resembles the Greek equivalent? How is it possible? I mean, of course, we know that there were Greek elements in Quenya. In Quenya, there are Greek strand words and was one of the roots of the language. And of course, we know that Numenor was originally supposed to be based on the Atlantis myth. But why can that say that? And if you want the rest of the lecture, I will try to explain a bit more what lies behind the joke we just read, the sort of idea that there is a coincidental etymological connection. Number 9 on the handout. To clarify this, first of all, I need to point out that when we talk about classical influences or classical ancestry of the myth of Atlantis, I think we should rather talk of a proper rewriting. I think the concept of rewriting, at least at the beginning, is a bit more appropriate. According to that unpublished version of the myth, which is known as the Lost Road, as I said, in this version of the road, in this version of the myth, the protagonist, who is clearly a Tolkien alter ego, should have gone back to the time of Atlantis and witnessed his collapse. And in a sense, this would have been the identification of Numenor with Atlantis as explicit as it could be. And in fact, as I put you there, the language that he used actually was, when he said the third passage, the language that he uses to refer to what he was doing. I quote, he was tooling around to what I really wanted to make, a new version of the Atlantis legend. So the very beginning was quite clear how, in a sense, and if you think about the imagery, I think it's very interesting because of its meta-literary implications. The author is presented as someone who was actually present at the fall of Atlantis and was writing his own version. So in Tolkien's vision, reception is somehow presented as a rewriting rewriting the same event that Plato was describing, but within, if you want, a different kind of knowledge. It's not like Tolkien was copying or adapting the version of Plato, he was giving his own version of the same fact. I will come back on this later on. We know therefore, even on the basis of what I just read, that very soon Tolkien understood that it was just simply rewriting the Platonic myth was not enough. Rather, he very soon felt compelled to integrate his own authorial mediation. He wanted to be there as an author, not as an adapter. That is to say, he wanted to complement untold part of the narrative, because there are many untold parts of the narrative in Plato's version. He wanted to complement them out of his own imagination. He changed names and details and inserted his own viewpoint, his own experience, his own creative idiosyncrasies into the stories, and slowly, what this rewriting of the Atlantis myth actually became a new story, which is, of course, the story of Numenor. It was therefore a creative urgency, we may say, that compelled Tolkien to create something different, something distant from his source, and this is what explains why he decided to abandon the story. As I read before, but let me read it again, my efforts after a few promising chapters ran dry. It was too long a way around to do what I really wanted to make. And what did he really want to make? A new version of the Atlantis legend. The key word is the adjective new version. It is what Tolkien wants to do is something new. And the idea of literary newness is central in Tolkien's theory, but also practice of literature. In fact, I quote from On Fairy Stories, his literary manifestos, if you want. In On Fairy Stories, Tolkien will say that this recovery the fairy stories help us to make includes a return, a renewal of that. It's a renewal. Or, even better, the following passage, just after, creative fantasy is mainly trying to do something else, to make something new. This is a very important idea. And the idea of newness and or renewal, because the two things are related, when you do something new, in a sense you are renewing in a new way something that was already in the past, this idea of newness and renewal is also central in the narratives. And if you think about Lord of the Rings, how important is the idea of renewal? The blade is renewed, the Aragorn is the renewer, and so forth and so forth. Tolkien's urgency for literary nuance, I think, explains why Tolkien decided, against his original intentions, to integrate the tale of Numenor into his own legendarium. That was not originally the plan. It was supposed to be a different story, but as always in Tolkien, the stories are kind of drawn together into this core narrative. In later years, number 10 on the handout, we see how Tolkien will be even bolder in claiming authorial freedom and originality. You can see how Tolkien, what I'm saying now, is really like explains much about how Tolkien considers reception. Not just classical reception, but reception in general. As you see in number 10 on the handout, I think it's very clear, the legends of Numenor are my own use for my own purposes of the Atlantis legend. It's no longer a rewriting or an adaptation, it's my own use. But not based on special knowledge, but on a special concern with this tradition. So you see how I think really this emphasis on the own purposes is very important from a literary point of view. And again, the second passage from a different letter, Numenor is my personal alteration of the Atlantis myth or tradition and accommodation, that's I think a key concept, accommodation of it to my general mythology. Of all the mythical or archetypical images, this is the one most depleted in my imagination. So you may note how Tolkien stresses again and again the personalism of his literature. His literature is personal. This emphasis on the personal, on the peculiar, on the individual, on the particular, on the special, is another key ingredient in Tolkien's literary recipe, which in his view according to both production and reception. Let me read you another passage from Fairy Stories, which I think is very illuminating, number 11 on the handout. Literature works from mind to mind, and it is thus more progenitive. It is at once more universal and more permanently particular. A key paradox. If he speaks of bread or wine or stone or tree, he appeals to the whole of these things, to their ideas. Yet, each hearer will give to them a peculiar personal embodiment in his imagination. So we see how the personal, in Tolkien's, if you want, paradoxical vision of literature, is just one pole, one of the two poles of a pair which cannot be divided. On the one side, we have indeed the particular, the special, but on the other side, we have the universal, or we may say the traditional, or we may say the pattern or the motif. I think we can illustrate this set of polarities between motive, pattern, and embodiment particular. We can illustrate this set with another passage, again from On Fairy Stories. It's a passage which presents an image, an analogy, but I think it's maybe the most effective way to explain what Tolkien had in mind. Who can design a new leaf, a new piece of literature, a new version of the Atlantis story? The patterns from bud to unfolding and the colors from spring to autumn were all discovered by men long ago. In a sense, as Terence, the Latin playwright, will say, everything has already been said. Literature has already been said everything. But, Tolkien adds, that is not true. Each leaf of oak and ash and thorn is a unique embodiment of the pattern. And for some, this very year may be the embodiment, the first ever seen and recognized, though oaks have put forth leaves from countless generations of men. So we can infer from this analogy that for Tolkien, every new personal event, life event, but also literary event, it could be the tale of Numenor, but it can also be the dream of Atlantis that Tolkien had. Each of these personal events is a unique embodiment of an archetypical motive. Don't have to talk more about it now, but we are in the 20s and 30s, where this relationship between the traditional and the particular was very present in the literary discourse. There was an important essay of T.S. Eliot on this, but for the moment we stay within Tolkien's own literary vision. And according to this vision, each embodiment of mode is somehow related to all of its previous embodiments. Like a leaf of a given year, it is related to all the other leaves of the other years. So the Numenor myth, it is related, according to Tolkien, to Plato's myth of Atlantis, of course, but it is related, if you want, by transitive property, by the fact that both of them are embodiment of the same pattern. We cannot really explain, in Tolkien's terms, we cannot explain this connection between Plato's Atlantis and Tolkien's Numenor in genealogical terms, within, for instance, a framework of intertextuality or source criticism. What Tolkien suggests, what Tolkien believed, is that, in a sense, there is something different which explains the connection. It may well be possible, of course, that the universal or traditional element, the pattern, the mode of the leaf, depends or is derived from previous embodiments. Of course, we may say that Plato kind of inferred embodiment, so the archetype from Plato. And yet, Tolkien suggests this remains unproven. I read this time a passage from The Monster and the Critics, another important essay. Of great interest to me is the attempt to disentangle the personal from the traditional, the embodiment from the archetype. These two are doubtless much interwoven, the personal being possibly, and that's a key qualification, an important qualification, though it is not proven, being possibly linked to the traditional in normal lives by heredity, as well as by the immediate and daily pressure of the traditional upon the personal from earliest childhood. So you see how the genealogical derivation model, whether it's, if you want, biological or literary, is not exclusive. We cannot, for Tolkien, just assume that Tolkien read Plato's Myth of Atlantis and then wrote the Numenor. That's not the pattern framework of reception we should use according to Tolkien. Rather, we may say that Atlantis Dream is just one of the sources of the Numenor story. And another important source is what he refers to as the pressure of the traditional upon the personal from earliest childhood. So in a sense, Tolkien does talk about the fall also in psychological terms. I don't want to go to psychoanalysis here, okay, but I don't think there is a big jump, okay, in terms of going and thinking about archetypes in a Jungian sense. In fact, as Tolkien says in another letter, number 12 on the handout, there cannot be any story without a fall. All stories are ultimately about the fall, at least not for human minds, you see the psychological dimension, at least not for human minds as we know them and have them. So we see that for Tolkien, we really should not talk in genealogical terms. In a sense, we should really talk, we may say, even in fatalistic psychological terms. Human beings cannot but write about the fall, and the fall of Numenor is just one embodiment of this archetype. And this, if you want, fatalistic outlook has also an important implication. And the implication is that this relationship between different modes of stories, that is to say, between Plato and Tolkien, is looked with a lot of skepticism and, if you want, even agnosticism. Yes, maybe there is an influence, but that's not what Tolkien is interested with. And I think you should understand now why Tolkien could claim half jokingly that the metaliterary allusiveness of the name Atalantia was just a curious chance. I think that behind that, it should be clear by now, there is this agnostic position towards source criticism, which is an agnosticism which is based on this idea that at the end of the day, we are more influenced by the archetype, by the mode, than by previous embodiments. So to sum up my journey so far, got another 10 minutes to go, but to sum up all the journey so far, I would say that Tolkien considers his own literary endeavor as consisting in producing a new personalized version of an archetypical theme or motive. And this can also involve, as we've seen, the alteration of accommodation of an earlier text, so in a sense, a pattern of reception. The myth of Atlantis is accommodated into his own mythology. And yet, rather than a source in a traditional sense, or better in a 20th century sense, this should be considered just an earlier version, an earlier embodiment of the same universal transcultural archetype, a leaf in a new season of the tree. It is at an inner, a deeper level of literature human experience that real influence is found, Tolkien suggests. Again, I don't have the time to discuss the analogs here, okay? For me, just enough to try to make you understand what Tolkien believed. Just like in the life of a tree, a new leaf is more influenced, but it is underlying pattern rather than by a leaf from previous year. So if you want to understand what was going on in the myth of Numenor, we shouldn't be too obsessed with the version of Plato. How this relation works at this more superficial level is for Tolkien unclear and in a sense not very interesting. As Tolkien says, this is last passage, passage number 13, I fear you may be right that the search for the sources of the Lord of the Rings is going to occupy academics for a generation or two. I wish this need not to be so. To my mind, it is the particular, you see, the particular use in a particular situation of any motive, whether invented, deliberately borrowed, or unconsciously remembered, not interested in whether of these three are, but the particular use is the most interesting thing to consider. So, everything after I said, about 5 minutes to go, at this point I think I would like to address the problem of the narrative decline, trying to follow Tolkien's invitations. That is to say, to phrase the question, what is then the personal, particular use of the traditional motive of the narrative decline, which clearly was deliberately borrowed or unconsciously remembered from his classical culture. So clearly that's the case, but this is less interesting. So, but what is then the particular use? And that will be the question that I will address in the very last stage of my journey today. Moving to number 14, I must say that there are many different ways to approach the question, so I don't have the time to go through all of them, simply because the embodiment of the motive is not just one. The motive of the narrative of the Klein in its different versions is found in different contexts and in different variants within the story. I will here only focus, also because it's a bit late, I will here only focus only on one specific use, which yet I think to be very important and significant. And this is the use, its use, in relation to the focalization through a viewpoint of the elves. The elves, in Tolkien's mythology, are, we may say, the definite characters par excellence. And that's something that he repeatedly suggests, and I quote from number 13, from 14. The elves became obsessed with fading, the mode in which the changes of time, the law of the world and the sun, was perceived by them. They became sad, and the arts, shall we say, antiquarian. Mentioned well, the antiquarianism always went hand in hand with narrative of the Klein. Their efforts all really a kind of embalming. So we see how the deadliness of the elves is seen, first of all, in their obsession with memory, their typical opposition to change, they are embalmers, and their related efforts to preserve the sort of golden age. And this is normally done, as you know, in The Lord of the Rings, in what we may call, using the Latin terms, the loci ameni, so happy places where time doesn't flow. And this is one of them, of course, is the timeless land of Lorien, which I don't think casually is the golden wood. There is something golden about Lorien, just the golden era of man. And the golden status of this place, this timeless place, I do think it really recalls Loki Ameni a bit like, I don't know, the countryside of Verdus Aethos, for instance, but there are many others. This status derives, as we know, from the power of Gordon's Ring. And the power of Gordon's Ring, that's what Tolkien said, that was the power of Gordon's Ring, I quote, "The power is the prevention of slowing of decay, we will say the slowing of decline, change viewed as a regrettable thing, the preservation of what is desire or love, or its semblance. This is more or less an Elvish motive." So we see how the Ed's viewpoint is analogous to the classical perception of time in history, or one of the most widespread perception of time in history. And I do think, actually, it would not be too far-fetched to say that the elves in many ways represent, although not fully embodied, but they certainly do represent the position of ancient Greek and Roman thinkers, of course, accommodated into Tolkien's mythology. The elves lie at the heart of Tolkien's mythology, and as we know, are the characters most beloved by Tolkien, or at least as beloved as the hobbits. And we know that he was compelled to write stories about the elves up from a young age. And yet, number 15, a very important point, Tolkien does not fully agree with the elves, stating in a letter that their Declinism, and thereby their conservatism, if you want, is problematic. I quote from number 15, if you turn the page, "The elves are not wholly good or in the right. They wanted to have their cake and eat it, to live in the mortal historical Middle-earth because they had become fond of it, and so try to stop its change in history, to stop its growth." For Tolkien, the elves' refusal of change, the elves' narrative of decline with all its implication, however understandable, is just a partial, problematic, and imperfect outlook of history. Because in his vision, a quote from letter 181, "mere change is not represented as evil. It is the unfolding of the story, and to refuse this is, of course, to go against the design of God. But the Elvish weakness is naturally to regret the past and to become unwilling to face change, as if a man were to wait a very long book still going on and wish to settle down in a favorite chapter." Or to read this in even more meta-literary terms, to stick with just one literary tradition and not move forward. So according to Tolkien, the changes brought about by time, however dramatic and traumatic, are not catastrophes to avoid or bemoan, but rather the law of the world under the sun, the mysterious unfolding history of creation to be embraced by the elves and all the other characters with hope and courage. To try to arrest this unfolding, to refuse to engage with change, is a temptation to overcome. The Elves' redemption, in fact, in The Lord of the Rings, if you remember, coincides with their acceptance to give up the power of the rings to lose Lorien. So Tolkien, therefore, accommodates the determinism of classical ancestry, but integrates it into a larger picture, focalizing into his characters, the elf, and thereby implicitly disclaiming any full assent to it. And that's a kind of detachment, authorial detachment, towards his characters, which is found again and again in his letters. I gave you on the handout a passage about Tom Bombadil, who, according to, I think it's Tom Bombadil, yes, according to Tom Bombadil, it does not really reflect what he thinks. Either Tom Bombadil or Tribard, don't know which one or two, but anyway, just another example of that. Tolkien certainly had anti-Declinist views, quite different from those of his beloved elves, and this can be also traced in his letters, when he talks, for instance, about an unwholesome modern thirst for the authentically primitive, or berates some Christian theologians for their primitivist views, noting that, I quote, "primitiveness is no guarantee of value and is and was in great part a reflection of ignorance." This may always be fine, I mean, okay, that makes a lot of sense, and yet, some questions are still open. How is it possible to reconcile these apparently progressive views of history with the undoubted pervasiveness of the narrative decline in his literary work? Again, I think that the notion of focalization is helpful. The whole of his legendarium, as we know, and especially the Silmarillion, according to Tolkien, is focalized from the point of view of the elves. I don't have the time to talk about it now, but there is very complex frame narratives that present the Silmarillion and all the other works are told by the points of view of particular actors. In fact, and I quote from letter 212, "it must be remembered that mythically these tales are elf-centered, not anthropocentric, and therefore an elvish view does not necessarily have anything to say with Christian beliefs or whatever." So what the elves believe, that is to say the version that he presents in his stories, it does not necessarily reflect truth. Of course, when we talk about focalization and frame narratives, we are talking about authorial constructs. Okay, clearly Tolkien did not find a manuscript, but I think it's a very revealing construct for which Tolkien self-reflects on an important mode of reception, including the classical reception. If earlier influential sources, like the myth of Atlantis, are accommodated into this new literary event by a process of focalization, for which they are, we may say, partialized, they become parts and integrated into a whole. The whole of the vision of the world of Tolkien, we may say, is superior to the parts, is superior to the points of view of the elves, and yet these individual parts, the Weltanschauungs, the points of view of the elves, are fully embraced and not censored or sanitized. They are integrated. There is, in fact, an awareness that you can get to the universal always if you start from the part. That's something Tolkien says explicitly in a letter. Among these parts, different parts in the whole of Tolkien's legendarium, certainly the part of the elves with their characteristic Declinism of clear classical ancestry has a primary position. And it does so not least because it certainly resonates with an important dimension of Tolkien's own human sensitivity, a sensitivity that had been wounded by the loss of his parents, a very early loss. He was wounded by the catastrophic First World War, and in general, he was wounded by the trauma of the sudden and precipitous end of an age, number 18 on the handout. It is in fact beyond doubt that the Declinist mode, the narrative of decline, forms parts of Tolkien's complex personality, despite, or rather together with, a more progressive, more positive outlook of history informed by his faith and experience. And that's something that Tolkien himself reflected on his letters. So I will conclude just with a very short passage when we see how these conflicting views coming together, which I do think reflects the same sort of presence of conflicting views, apparently conflicting views, into his literary work. I quote from the last passage, "A small knowledge of history depresses one with the sense of the everlasting mass and weight of human iniquity, old, old, dreary, endless, repetitive, unchanging, incurable weakness." A real classical narrative of decline framework. "All towns and villages, all habitation of men sinks." And at the same time, and we see how there's the counter agent here, "at the same time, one knows there is always good, much more hidden, much less clearly discerned, seldom breaking out into recognizable, visible beauties of words or deeds or faiths." So as suggested by this final quote, Tolkien considers even his oblique perception of life and history as true but partial, just like that of the elves and his classical sources. Perception which is partial, which is, if you want, problematic, and yet which is nevertheless embraced. And a position that Tolkien, in which Tolkien recognized a value and a beauty, and which he exercised into his art and used it as a fool for it. Thank you very much, and sorry for the not too long.